Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler, and today we're hearing from all corners of the world, from voters in India, from consumer review fans in London, and even from some world leaders. Mrs. Scholz and Xi, the leaders of Germany and China, have been meeting head to head, speaking about growing trade tensions. Is there any peace between them in sight? Plus, we'll be hearing from a Kenyan doctor who defends his right to strike for better pay despite the growing struggles of patients there.
If I see you today as my patient, even if the strike started, I am still going to continue with you as my patient. But it is my free will to take action against the government.
More on that later in the show. First, though, the big picture, if you will. The global economy, which could be set to grow at 3.2% this year, slightly more than was previously expected. That's according to the International Monetary Fund. It is optimistic, and its report published today, today's keenly awaited global growth forecast, suggests that the world could be heading for a soft landing rather than a crash over the next few months. It is good news, but still a mixed picture, according to Mohamed El Erian. He's the president of Queen's College, Cambridge, and a former deputy director of the IMF and a chief economic advisor at Allianz.
It is a positive take, and it's associated with what the IMF characterizes as surprising resilience for the global economy. Having said that, they stress that we are likely to see more divergent outcomes. And the underlying theme is one of a multiple transitions that different countries are going to be able to handle differently.
Yeah, I mean, that means the US is doing pretty well, India's doing pretty well, but lots of other places aren't.
Correct. And they express concerns that not only is the average growth rate of these other places low, but their fiscal buffers, the ability to absorb any shocks, has been run down, and they have this notion that we live in a more shock-prone world.
Can we just look at inflation, first of all? Because, of course, so much of the global conversation has been around inflation and interest rates over the last couple of years. What is their take on that? I mean, what are we expecting over the next few months?
So their take is that inflation has come down faster than expected. However, they are starting to recognize what others have recognized, which is labeled as a difficulty of the last mile. The notion that inflation has now gotten to the stage where it is more sticky and is going to be harder to bring down to central banks' 2% inflation target. What they don't take up, and I understand why diplomatically they haven't, is the key question, is 2% the right inflation target?
Yeah, because it's kind of arbitrary one, isn't it? We've talked about this before. It was set ages ago as somehow notionally the best number for inflation. But many people think, you know, why two? Why not 2.5? Why not 3?
Correct. It was set in the early 1990s by New Zealand. And it was an experiment in what was called inflation targeting. The experiment worked well, so it was adopted by other countries with very different attributes. You know, it is strange that countries that differ in the structure have the same inflation target. We're talking here of the US, of the Eurozone, of the UK, of New Zealand, of Australia. But it became this arbitrary number, and it didn't matter because the world was experiencing so many positive supply shocks that inflation wasn't a problem. But now that inflation has become a problem and we've been above target consistently, we should be asking the question, is that the right target in a world which is becoming more inflexible on the supply side and where fragmentation has replaced globalization.
Okay, well, so central banks are going to take different views on what the right level is, or at least where to set their interest rates to bring inflation down. I guess they're all still notionally at least targeting the 2% figure. But what should we be looking out for in terms of the risks? I mean, obviously, this is just a forecast. Forecasts can be wrong, and there's always geopolitical hazards on the horizon, aren't there?
Correct. You know, the IMF has moved to a balanced risk scenario, so thinking that the risks out there are balanced. I think if they knew then what they know now about the geopolitics, I suspect that the balance of risk would not have been balanced, would have been to the negative side.
You mean war escalation in the Middle East, for instance?
More escalation, oil prices going higher, that having a stagflationary impact, meaning it will undermine growth and push up inflation. You know, this issue is particularly relevant for Europe when it comes to growth, and it's particularly relevant for the U.S. when it comes to inflation. And the one thing that we cannot afford is a derailment of U.S. economic exceptionalism, because it is acting as the only locomotive for global growth right now.
Yeah, just quickly talk me through that, because as you say, all of the global growth seems to be very much focused on the strength of the US economy, but a very strong US economy and central bank rates accordingly has its problems, doesn't it, for creating imbalances in the rest of the world?
Two in particular. It means that US interest rates will be higher than what they would have been otherwise. And it means that the US dollar will be stronger than it would be otherwise. Now, that matters because the dollar is the reserve currency. So the US is exporting higher interest rates and a stronger currency. And that is something that other countries are going to have to deal with at a time when their own economic situation is not as strong. Now, there are, by the way, exceptions. India, for example, is portrayed correctly as a fast-growing economy that not only has achieved a growth rate of 7.8% last year, but is expected to grow above 6% this year and next year. So India has become the star performer in the developing world, displacing China.
The president of Queen's College, Cambridge, Mohammed El Arian. More on India in a minute. But listening to that with us, Fiona Cincotta, she's the senior market analyst at City Index. Hi, Fiona. I mean, he's touched on this, hasn't he? All eyes today are still on how Israel could respond to the latest direct attacks from Iran and what a flare-up in that situation might mean, for instance, for global oil prices.
Yes, exactly. You know, it does feel like the market is sort of on tenterhooks, and I think the ball is very much in Israel's court as to whether the whether there is an escalation to the tensions in the Middle East or not. And yes, and the impact that that will have on oil. And we know that if we do have higher oil prices, then that can then feed through across the economy, you know, pushing up prices across a broad a range of sectors, which, you know, increases inflation again. So, you know, I think central banks are going to be keeping a very close eye on oil prices as we head across the second quarter.
Yeah, it just so happens, of course, as well, that the IMF report comes just as we've had this new growth figure from China the first quarter of this year, 5.3% growth. That's slightly higher than had been forecast. What are we making of this? China, of course, is seen as a big threat, isn't it, globally? I mean, its
yes.
Economy.
Yeah, so I mean, China's GDP, it did come in stronger than expected at 5.3%, you know, so it was an encouraging start to this year. But I think if we look at more data that was also released from China for March, it does suggest that the bounce was actually very much in the first 2 months of the year. So we also had retail sales data, which fell to 3.1%. We also had industrial production, which was also weaker than expected. So I think that actually does suggest that perhaps this underperformance in production and private demand means that the recovery might actually be on thin ice. So we could see a slowdown as we continue through the year.
Fiona Cincotta, thank you. All of this also comes as the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has been meeting with China's President Xi Jinping in Beijing. President Xi has been warning that both sides should be wary of the rise in protectionism and should insist instead on looking at production capacity issues objectively. Here's some of what he had to say.
China and Germany are the second and third largest economies in the world. The significance of consolidating and developing relations between China and Germany is bigger than just bilateral relations and has an important impact on the Eurasian continent and even the entire world.
Joining us today is Jens Rupert. He is a board member of the German Asia Pacific Business Association. He's based in Singapore. Hi, Jens. Good to have you with us. We've had the IMF report and we've been looking, haven't we, at this Scholz meeting. I mean, what did you take from the meeting? Was Olaf Scholz pushing hard against this sort of growing sense that China might be dumping goods, particularly technology, new technologies, green technologies on Europe and America, or was it a more conciliatory approach, do you think?
Yeah, I think, first of all, it is extremely important that Chancellor Scholz was in China, visiting not only the political leadership, but some of the countries. This visit has been slightly different in terms of what he actually did. He was accompanied by, of course, delegation of German businesses and companies, but he visited Chongqing, which is one of the largest cities in the world. He then flew to Shanghai to meet with students and business people. And last but not least, if you want, as the political highlight, he met Xi Jinping. I think, yes, he did address, as far as we know, he addressed the concerns the Germans have. In particular, you mentioned he addressed some of the issues of the permanent overcapacity of Chinese companies in areas such as steel, solar, wind power, or batteries, and the state-subsidized development of these new industries, leading to massive price dumping.
That's true? Yeah. There is price dumping going on from Chinese goods on European markets, and that is a genuine legitimate risk for the European Union?
Well, that, even if it be not price dumping, even if the Chinese companies would, produce at much lower cost, of course, that is indeed a risk for European companies. But on the other hand, I think talking about competition, and I think we heard that from the Mercedes boss, Ole Källenius, who said, what we really can't have as an export nation in Germany are increasing barriers to trade. So I think it's a fine line of approving and accusing somebody, dumping prices or massive price dumping and real competitive advantages.
So a pressure on conciliation, in brief. That's what you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Jens Rupert, thank you very much indeed. Jens Rupert there speaking to me from Singapore. Now to India, where nearly 1 billion Indians are going to be eligible to go to the polls over the next couple of months in the world's biggest elections. The voting starts this week. Among the big factors on voters' minds could be things like job opportunities and rising prices there. Here are the thoughts of a couple of young job seekers speaking on the streets of the capital, New Delhi.
For me, the inflation is rising, prices of basic things are rising, and jobs are a major issue at this point, because for a graduate and a postgraduate like me, I'm still struggling to find jobs.
The government is working on infrastructure, but see what will the youth do with the infrastructure if there is no employment.
Well, despite the concerns expressed there, opinion polls do seem to indicate that it should be an easy win for the Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Our reporter Arunaday Mukherjee has been out on the road for us. Arunaday, we've been hearing about the speed of India's growth this month in that IMF report earlier in the show. I mean, but it's complicated, isn't it? Because it's a tough time for graduates in India, like those guys we've just been hearing from. Good growth figures, but not always jobs at the end of them.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's important to contextualize this. So on paper, India remains one of the fastest growing economies in the world. It is now the fifth largest economy, on track to overtake countries like Japan and Germany to become the third largest in the next 3 years. And you see, it is this report card that is being sold to the voters by Prime Minister Modi's government ahead of elections. You know, a narrative that says India is finally becoming this big global economic powerhouse under the ruling BJP over the last 10 years. But having said that, and just to go back to the kind of voices that you heard from the streets of India, it's important to also put some facts. This development that we've seen has also not reached one and all. If you talk about unemployment, for instance, which is one of the big factors which India's opposition parties are trying to raise and corner the government, according to the International Labour Organization, unemployment among educated youth, mind you, educated youth, has doubled 35% to 65% in the last 20 years. So that is a staggering figure. Graduates are basically looking for jobs, which is a huge concern. And these are issues that are being raised repeatedly by political parties in the country. The other aspect that you heard in one of the interviews was someone saying, you know, what are we going to do with infrastructure if there are no jobs? That's an important aspect, because infrastructure is something that this government has really been pushing. They've been spending big on infrastructure, and those are those big ticket investments which are visible, tangible, quote unquote, achievements that the government is trying to showcase ahead of these elections.
And yet they don't seem to be making that big a dent on the polls, these concerns. Certainly in the Hindi-dominated northern states, the BJP appears to be the salient party.
That's right. And those are the states which are going to be very important to watch out, especially the state of Uttar Pradesh, which has the maximum number of lawmakers that it sends to the Indian parliament, a whole of 80. And these are the areas where the BJP has really swept these regions in the last elections as well. There is general anticipation, according to various opinion polls, that they will do very well in these polls as well. And these are also states which have seen these kind of tangible achievements in infrastructure projects. You see, everywhere you look when you're driving around India, there's construction happening. There's highways, airports, ports, metros. In fact, this government has allocated nearly $100 billion in infrastructure spending every year since 2019, compared to $30 billion before that. But again, as I said, this development has generated hasn't been for all. According to an inequality database, the World Inequality Database, inequality in India has widened to a 100-year high. So it's important to note that there has been development as well. But whether this development has reached every single Indian is a question that is being raised in the political discourse as we go ahead with elections.
Those elections are taking place over several weeks, aren't they? We're going to have to wait till June to get the actual outcome. But for now, thank you very much. That's the BBC's Arunoday Mukherjee speaking to me from New Delhi. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Service. Now, in the US, the Federal Trade Commission is currently considering new rules to punish what's being described as a growing global industry in fake consumer reviews. Online reviews have become the standard yardstick of how many of us make our buying decisions, from that latest electronic gadget to the choice of a hotel or a restaurant. But campaigners say that more and more of what we read online isn't what it appears, as I've been finding out, starting with opinions on the streets of London. Hi there. Consumer reviews. Do you use them a lot?
I use for the trips, especially for the hotels, for the restaurants as well.
And you?
Yeah, we use, like, hotels. The meat is overcooked or undercooked or something like this.
Do you trust them?
Most of the time, yes.
It depends. Sometimes you can sense the fake review like right away, but sometimes it's hard. Maybe somebody paid that customer to write the bad review. You don't know?
The scope of the problem is just massive, Ed, and I think it's much, much worse than most people are aware of.
That's Kay Dean. She's a former criminal investigator turned activist who now runs an organization called Fake Review Watch.
Some experts put the percentage as high as 45 to 50% of reviews are fake. Google said it removed or blocked over 170 million policy-violating reviews in 2023. And Amazon blocked more than 200 million suspected fake reviews in 2022. So it's just staggering, the scope of the problem. No one's immune to this fraud. And right now, the current system, in my opinion, you know, it rewards cheating. And consumers and honest businesses are getting harmed.
So basically, businesses are all just doing it because they reckon everyone else is doing it, so they might as well.
I think the current environment is the Wild West.
The scale of what Kay Dean's describing here covers all kinds of activity, from petty vindictiveness by customers to professional vendettas. Four-star and five-star reviews can be easily bought these days from digital marketers for as little as a few dollars per review. Yaya Cohen is a UK lawyer specialising in helping firms in such cases.
I mean, if you have a pizzeria that's been operating for many years and then suddenly there is a fake review campaign alleging all sorts of things that are not true, that could result in bankruptcy or shutting down the business. This is, I believe, one of the most significant problems that exist. Other businesses not playing by the book, they're not playing it fair.
What in practice are the current obligations on companies and on consumers when it comes to reviews? Can you effectively sue someone for libel on these platforms?
Yes, you can. So whether a business should go and take legal action against individual consumers is a matter that they will have to consider very carefully. The publication has to be substantially true. So even if some elements of the review aren't completely accurate, that may not necessarily result in you being able to sue for defamation because the substantial matter is true.
What are the legal obligations for the review platforms themselves?
Unfortunately, the review platforms have very few obligations. They are not accountable. They don't publish any methodology that could be transparent and people can understand. Technically, in the UK, there is a legal obligation. So you could potentially go after the platform, but the court hasn't really approved that approach yet.
So in Britain, it seems, third-party review platforms like TripAdvisor, Trustpilot, Google, Yelp and Amazon, generally, they get to evade legal responsibility for any defamatory content placed on their sites. In the US, such legal protections are actually written into the statutes. Well, none of the main platforms, Google, Amazon or Facebook, were available to speak to me for this program. Google did say in a recent statement, "When we find bad actors trying to mislead people, we take swift action, ranging from content removal to account suspension and even litigation." One review platform that would speak to me was TripAdvisor. It calls itself the world's leading review site for hotels, restaurants and other tourist sites. Becky Foley is its head of trust and safety.
TripAdvisor has been hard at work at this for over 23 years. We've used the experience that we've got in those 23 years to build an industry-leading fraud detection system.
Do you think that you have trust of the traveler community out there?
Absolutely. I think we're the leading trusted global platform for travel reviews. Are there new threats? Are there new tactics that people are trying to use? Absolutely. But like I said, we've got this really talented team of investigators and fraud analysts. Maybe they're not going to catch that fake review today, but they will absolutely catch it in the future. And they're going to catch all of the fake reviews to protect travelers.
Becky Foley of the review platform TripAdvisor. And you can hear more from my investigation into fake reviews and the legal questions around it in today's edition of Business Daily, wherever you get your podcasts. Hospital doctors in Kenya are preparing to hold a march to the Ministry of Health in the capital, Nairobi, a month after starting a continuous strike over pay. The doctors in state-run medical centres accuse the government of being in arrears with salary payments and of failing to hire trainee doctors on pre-agreed terms. Opposition leaders have threatened to join the march to compel the government to listen to the doctors' demands. Earlier today, I spoke to a surgeon, Dr. Andrew Wainaina.
Ideally, in a negotiation situation, you should have both parties come to the table and have a talk. But most of what has been happening, the Ministry of Health chest thumping and not willing to come to the table to discuss with the union leaders. They do these closed door meetings. They're discussing the wage bill. They're basically purporting to be discussing issues which encompass the entire public service, including doctors. But they haven't come to the table to extend a hand.
You are striking over a range of issues, aren't you? Pay, the failure to hire trainee doctors who can't qualify without getting an intern position. There are different issues. For you personally, as a kind of trainee surgeon, what matters most?
I think where I sit from, this is an issue that is going to affect the dignity of all doctors in this country. Then what we are saying is we are going to have a health workforce which is going to be barely efficient in future. You're not going to have interns who actually put themselves out there. You're going to have people who come into the field and they're dejected, they're demoralized. So it starts with the interns. It goes on to the residents, because once you go into residency again, you're still in a training situation and you're in the same point, if not worse off.
Kind of pay are you getting at the moment?
I get a net salary of 190,000 thereabout.
What is that roughly in US dollars?
Around 1,000 and something.
1,500 maybe. That looks
net.
Like...
That is net salary.
Yeah.
Per month. Yeah.
So that's about 1,500 US dollars per month, which sounds like a generous salary.
Yeah, but you see, Ed,
to I guess a lot of Kenyans.
So after internship and you work in public service for a few years, your county continues paying your salary while the central government is meant to pay your school fees in one of the universities where you've gotten a chance to go and further your education. But we have people who are self-sponsored, who are in the same training program that I am in. We put in the same amount of work, the same amount of hours. Our schedule is the same. Yet these people don't have any source of pay. They're not getting reimbursed.
So that is the situation with the doctors. But there are problems for patients now, aren't there? This strike's been going on for a month, and we're hearing reports of lots of patients having a really hard time in Kenya. The hospitals aren't working right now because of the strike. Do you feel for the patients out there who aren't getting treated?
I feel very bad where I'm seated. But at the end of the day, we are human beings. When I go home, I am a father. I am somebody's son. I cater for all these people's needs. Ourselves, our relatives are still getting sick wherever they are. If my mom fell ill today, I probably will have a colleague in a private hospital who can help sort me out. But the truth is, I may not even be able to afford those services. I'm not even covered adequately for my healthcare needs as a doctor in this country. God forbid I get a chronic illness. But the thing is, we care about all human lives, but we don't neglect anybody that we have gotten into a contract with. If I see you today as my patient, even if the strike started, I am still going to continue with you as my patient. It is my free will to take action against the government.
The striking Kenyan surgeon, Dr. Andrew Wainaina, ending this edition of World Business Report. From me and the rest of the team, thanks for listening.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.